I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics' viral tubing mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS. .com/thrive for 20% off your first order.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find the Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
You're listening to Muses. My name is Lynx, and I hope you enjoy the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Muses. We are the podcast all about women of rock and roll. Today, I have a super special guest, my good friend, Martin Bryan. My listeners would know you from the photos that you've taken of me and Shanti. Oh, well, hello. Is that wine good?
It's delicious. Hi, everyone.
Great introduction. Yes, we're just having a glass of wine, hanging out. It's been a while. This is really special because it's been a long time since I've done one of these in person. And usually I'm on Zoom looking at a face on a screen. So to see you in person and to be able to have a glass of wine, want to cheers?
Cheers. There you go. It's much needed.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
These COVID days.
Yeah.
What a mess.
And we were planning this before COVID even started.
Oh, for
started.
So long we've been planning. And I think we wanted to do it virtually, but I'm like, no.
Yeah.
No.
We thought about it, but it was like, let's wait. Let's like do it right. And I'm so glad because, it's been a while and I'm so happy to be doing this with you too. Martin and I worked at Massey Hall together. So you're a music lover. You appreciate women in music.
Mm-hmm.
You appreciate women behind the scenes.
Absolutely.
And you're, again, an amazing photographer. So it seemed right to talk about Annie Leibovitz with you.
Everyone loves Annie.
Everyone loves Annie, and for good reason. She's amazing. I don't really know that much about her. I know her work, obviously. We all know her work. And I am excited because you're the one telling me this story. So I get to kind of sit back and listen and we can chat. But yeah, I got to like kind of take a break and let someone else do the research this time. So thank you for that as well.
Well, hopefully I don't fuck it up. All right.
You're good.
All right. So it all begins, folks, on October 2nd, 1949. Annie Leibovitz was born in Waterbury, Connecticut. I hope I didn't say that wrong. But I was born October 1st, 1988. Ooh. And if my mom kept me in for another day,
you would have had the same birthday.
Great thing. Yeah. Like, I mean, it would have been the same birthday.
My dad was born in 1949, too.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. Interesting.
Good year.
Good year. These are the psychic connections. So she's basically the middle child of five other siblings and the daughter of Marilyn Edith, who was a dance instructor, and Samuel Lebowitz, who was a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force. By the way, I always mess up her last name. Like, I will say it like three or four different ways before.
And it's not the wine.
It's not the wine. It's it's not the wine. The wine will probably actually make it consistent through the whole time. Which is interesting, actually, because my dad was actually in the Navy, so he was in the Army, and I moved around a lot. Not so much like her. She was basically raised in a car. I was not raised in a car. And my mom worked on a fish plant, so it wasn't as poetic as her mom as a dancer. But yeah, so her dad was in the Army, and they traveled a lot. And it's interesting, actually, because her and her family were so against the war, like the Vietnam War, and her dad served in it.
Wow.
For quite a while, yeah. And it was basically her, I don't know, I guess it would be her mom and her father that kind of introduced her to photography, but in two different kind of ways. I think her mom was more of the informal kind of introduction to photography. I guess her mom kind of brought the camera along on like family kind of get-togethers, and it was kind of an extension of her. So the family was kind of very used to
getting documented.
Yeah, gotcha. Absolutely. Like, it was basically the mom was documenting the family versus her father, who basically made her move to the Philippines with him.
Wow.
Yeah. And he really wanted her to go to the Philippines University, but she turned that down before moving to San Francisco with her sister, which is
San Francisco.
Yeah, San Francisco.
Good choice.
Cue the music. Yeah. No. Yes, a better choice than, I guess, Philippines University. But when she was in the Philippines, that was when she first was introduced to the darkroom. So, which is really exciting.
Wow. So it was like pretty young that she really kind of got into it.
Yeah. And it's interesting because she says that she was never really interested in photography. But, you know, I feel like sometimes our like attitudes and behaviors are completely different. I feel like her behaviors kind of show that she actually was interested in photography to begin with. Like, it kind of just like she positioned
it was natural
her. It was just natural for her. And I feel like that's with like a lot of us, you know what I mean, where we think that we're not really good at something or we're not actually interested in something, but like we're doing it anyways.
For sure. I grew up wanting to be in film, and I still love film so much, but I was so focused on that. And since I was a kid, I've always done music related jobs and just life things. And it wasn't until I was like 25 to 30 where I was like, wait a minute, maybe I should just focus on the music thing. Like, why am I doing this when it's obvious that like this is my path? Like, it's presented to me and I'm not taking it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, like a lot of people really discount their hobbies. Like, they don't think that their hobbies can be something that could be life fulfilling or,
very
you know,
true,
a career.
Yeah.
And they really could. You
absolutely
know, like you just have to put a lot of time into it. And I think that a lot of us focus a lot on the money, and it makes sense. I mean, we obviously need money to survive, but at the same time, it's like, okay, like as long as our needs are fulfilled, as long as we can like house ourselves and feed ourselves. And with that being said, a lot of people can't, but you know, it's just,
we're good examples
things
of that. Like, yeah. I never thought, oh, my groupie knowledge would ever come to this.
Totally.
And yeah, like you're an amazing photographer, and seeing like your progression in your work from like hobby to now, you know, professional photographer is amazing.
Oh God, that sounds like so
professional.
Like, I was gonna say pretentious. But it is. It's like,
true.
I'm a professional photographer.
You are, though.
No, like some people come to me, they're like, oh, you're a photographer, but are you a professional photographer? And I'm like, I don't know what that means.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting. Okay, so
back to San Francisco?
Back to San Francisco. So she moved to San Francisco completely against her father's wishes. Like, he did not want her to move to San Francisco. I'm not sure why, but she moved to the Bay Area close to her sister and rented an apartment with some friends where she used one of the closets of their bedroom. So she, like, lived in a closet space for a while. She was basically a Harry Potter.
Oh, my God. I thought you meant, like, she made a dark room in the closet.
No, no. Like, she lived... She lived in a closet like Harry Potter. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it was under the stairs, but if it was, you know, Annie, if you're listening to this, please let us know. And so she started to feel community within the photography wing at her university. So she actually started university like as a painter.
Oh.
And it's funny because she kind of like jokes about how she wanted to be like an art teacher, but she didn't realize that she had to actually like become an artist to become an art teacher, which I totally appreciate. Yeah. I also had that realization out of high school. I'm like, oh, I could just do this. Like,
yeah, yeah. Gotta live a little, gotta produce something.
You actually have to have a body of work.
That's so fascinating though. Again, like painter to photographer. Mm-hmm. It does make sense.
It totally makes sense, especially for, like, her newer stuff.
Yeah.
They're very kind of, like, in my opinion, they look like classic paintings. They're very, like, you know, Michelangelo slash, I don't know, Rembrandt.
For sure. No, for sure. I see it. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Especially for her closer kind of detailed portraits, I feel like they're very Rembrandt versus a lot of her newer stuff, I feel like, is kind of delving into the Caravaggio, you know, painter. A lot of them are very, like, kind of environmental. There's a lot of detail. There's a story kind of going on. Mm-hmm. As to maybe, like, not her earlier career, but her mid-career, it was very focused on, like, you know, who the artist was, and she wanted to kind of portray that in her photographs. And yeah. I don't think a lot of portrait photographers were doing that at the time. So, for example, Whoopi Goldberg, where she took a photo of Whoopi Goldberg in a milk bath. And
oh,
so
yeah. I can picture it.
That was,
she's like smiling and like,
having fun in that milk bath. Yeah. And Whoopi was like, no, it looked a lot better than it actually was, because apparently milk is pretty disgusting to bathe in. Like, oh, yeah. It sounds really nice to do, but it's actually disgusting. Like, you see the floaties and stuff, and it was just like, get me out of here, apparently. Yeah, it was cold.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, the photo turned out great.
It was worth it, for
it
sure.
It was worth it. But that was representative of, I guess, Whoopi's, one of Whoopi's stage performances of, you know, like, basically being this, like, black comedian in, like, a white world. Yeah. And, like, you know, so it was like basically her first time that kind of she realized that, you know, she could portray her subjects as themselves, or like bringing a piece of their life into the portrait.
I got you. Instead of just like a candid, you're thinking about it. There's a message there. There's a story there.
Exactly. Yeah. There's an actual story. It's conceptual at that point. And before that, it wasn't very conceptual. It was like, you know, they were portraits, you know? And her first photo of John Lennon, for example, she was just like checking the meter on her camera.
Oh, no way.
And then it would just like turned out to be a great photo. And they actually put that on the cover of Rolling Stones. So
nice.
Pretty great.
So she's in San Francisco. She's living in the cupboard. Or closet, sorry. Closet. No. I'm like, she's tiny.
She was living in a cupboard, yeah. So she was going to school for painting. She wanted to become a painter. And then she started hanging out with the people in the dark room, all of these photographers. And, you know, she quoted the whole San Francisco vibe in, like, the 1960s as, like, love, love, love. And, like, everyone was trying to just, like, probably fucking each other. I mean, for why sure. not? Like, we still do that. I feel like we've just gone back to the 60s. We love free love, people. We love it. So, yeah, while she was spending her time in university, the whole, you know, riots and, I mean, I don't want to say riots, but like protests, I guess, Vietnam, they were happening at the time. And so she took like a fuckload of photos of these protests. And then her boyfriend at the time was like, hey, Annie, like, let's go to Rolling Stones. Like, we're going to submit these photos. And I think there was a point where she was like, oh, like, you know, like, I don't really want to submit them. But her boyfriend kind of pushed her. And so she went to Rolling Stones and then she showed them her photos, and then she was walking outside one day and then she found one of her photos of like a protest on the front cover.
Oh my god, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And this is like sort of when Rolling Stone magazine was
becoming a thing.
So she was like part of it, basically.
I mean, it wasn't mainstream at the time, like no one really knew what, like, they knew what Rolling Stones was, but it wasn't like it is today. Yeah. Like, it's, you know,
it was at its beginnings.
Mm-hmm, the beginnings.
Yeah.
And so that's how she started. And then from there, she started touring with the Rolling Stones.
Oh.
Which was...
Party City?
It was a party city, yeah. So it was known for photographers to be going on the road with them. Like, it was known for them to contribute in the drug use. And
you gotta partake if you're...
You have to partake.
Yeah. It was a wild time, like you said. Like, sex, love, drugs. Mm-hmm. I can only imagine, like, Keith Richards at that time and, like... yeah, how do you not?
Well, Keith Richards really liked her, actually, because she was such a fly on the wall. Like, they didn't even realize that she was there taking photos, really.
I remember one specific Keith Richards photo that I'm pretty sure Annie took of him kind of, like, passed out on a chair like this. Like, I had that on my wall as a teenager.
Yeah.
Very, like, iconic moment and very, like, Keith.
Very Keith.
In that time.
Very Keith. He has a quote saying, "She was one of the first female photographers that I remember. This is interesting. See how long she lasts. But she hung in. She felt very unobtrusive, and you never thought anything about her taking pictures." So again, like, she was like a fly on the wall. She was like very unobtrusive. She didn't really want to go in there to fit in. I mean, she did drugs, I guess, when they offered it to her.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like she knew that this wasn't really her life.
That's so interesting to like see how long she lasts like as a woman in this industry.
Well, I think a lot of the women who were obviously touring with the Rolling Stones, I think, you know, they obviously had sex with the Rolling Stones and then they were kind of like out. Like,
yeah, maybe,
you know, like they had their time versus Annie. I mean, whether she slept with some of them or not, it's no one knows, I guess, other than, you know, her and the posse. But, you know, I feel like Annie also has like this very masculine presence about her. Like she has this like kind of, you know, this like hair to her that like I think a lot of men would at that time.
She has a strong energy.
She's a very strong energy. So I think a lot of men at the time would kind of like associate her with them. Like,
yeah.
I think it was like a very natural for her to be on a road with them.
Versus, I hear you.
Yeah.
There's like an automatic respect there because like she's on their level.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It isn't a sexual thing. It's like a professional thing.
And there's obviously problems with that because.
Oh, for sure. You know? For sure.
But, you know, she did it. And I think she was like really a woman of her time. You know what I mean? It's like not a lot of women were treated the way that she was treated
it's
as an equal.
It's interesting, too, because the only other photographer I can think of that time that's a woman that was in that scene is Linda McCartney, and she's a very, very different energy than Annie. She is more, like, sweet and loving, and that's, like, an interesting dynamic there, too. Like, and their photographs are so different.
Yeah.
They both capture a different side of these musicians, and it's really cool. It's really cool that they each kind of had their own vision.
Yeah. Hillary Clinton is quoted. I mean, I don't know the exact quote, but she basically just says that Annie Leibovitz really kind of personifies these people as people, not necessarily like celebrities. Mm-hmm. She kind of like grounds them into like they're human.
Yeah.
And I think especially now that is so important.
That's why I really love her photos in Rolling Stone and everything, too, because, like, they do feel like candids, like you said, like a fly on the wall. She's capturing these moments. You're just seeing someone in their element, and you can tell that they're so comfortable with her because they aren't posing. They aren't putting something on. They're not noticing her. So they are really phenomenal.
And I think that's the number one obstacle with being a photographer is, like, getting the subject to be comfortable with you. And I don't know if it's, like, easier to not know the subject before coming into the situation. Because sometimes when it's your friend, I feel like they have, like, these expectations. And it's kind of, like, you know, they don't want to look bad in front of you. And so it's, like, creating that comfort level and that vibe.
Yeah.
I mean, it could have been the drugs.
I'm sure the drugs help.
But I do also believe it's Annie. Like
absolutely.
Annie has a power that most people do not have.
You know for sure she's going to capture an iconic
And you're going to look good.
Yeah.
Like, she's not one of these photographers where, like, you're in mid-sentence.
Yeah.
And no judgment at all for photographers who do that. Like, I think that's a whole different vibe. And I love that. But I think that, she's going to make you look good, you know, or at least she's going to try. She doesn't work miracles, folks, but
she'll find the moment.
She'll take the photo.
And
that was a lot of work for her at the beginning. She even says herself that it was like really hard for her to make people look good in photos, you know. And then again, like kind of going back to what I said before, it was kind of, you know, like bringing something that they do already into the photo and kind of like making it their own.
Yeah.
I think for her, she found that was like a comfort thing to make people comfortable. And I think maybe like, you know, the Rolling Stones, like that was what they were comfortable doing.
Yeah. I did not know that she toured with bands. I assume she probably toured with other
bands.
It was
the beginning of a career, that's for sure, with the Rolling Stones. And then, you know, a drug addiction kind of went over. Nothing that I really, like, read or watched, they really talked about what drugs that she did. But I do know that she really liked cocaine.
Didn't they all?
Yes. She loved the cocaine.
It's a hell of a drug.
Yeah. Well, I think the reason why she loves cocaine, and I'm sure so many people do love cocaine, it's because, like, it makes you think that you're talking a lot, but really you're all just talking bullshit.
Endless energy. Mm-hmm. You feel like you're on top of the world.
Yeah. It seems like there's a lot of substance at the time, but really it's just a lot of substance at the time.
I'm sure everyone at Rolling Stone magazine, they probably had like cupboards full.
Just book bags. Yeah, and that's when they didn't really check your bags back then. So could you imagine?
In Keith Richards' book, he talks about accidentally bringing a gun in his suitcase at the airport, and no one noticed it. Like, he didn't mean to. It was just like...
Right, it was just a thing.
And then he realized after, like, oh, shit.
I got caught with a lighter once. It wasn't
you
my
bad
bag.
Boy.
I know. Try to smuggle lighters, folks, on the airplane. It was like, so they obviously called us over to security. They're like, why are you bringing a lighter on the airplane? And we're like, oh my God. Like, obviously we didn't mean this.
Times have changed.
Times have changed.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm. You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
So she was obviously based in San Francisco, doing the whole Rolling Stones thing, traveling with the band. And obviously everyone noticed that she had a problem. So she went to rehab. She did rehab and she was fine. Like, she was just one of those people who like broke through
it. One and done?
Yeah, good and done. And I think it's with a lot of people who have addictions. Like, some people have the addiction because it's like their life. Versus some other people, they have the addiction because it's, you know, the people who they're hanging out with, or it's like, you know, like they're not really holding on to the addiction. Like, they can easily make the change, but mm-hmm. it's just, it's
you have fun, you're doing drugs, you enjoy it, mm-hmm. as opposed to like you're using the drugs to mask something
in your life. Like some emotional trauma, yeah. You know.
Yeah.
And I don't think that she, I mean, I don't know if she experienced trauma in her life. I you know, that is on her to know, and nobody else to know until she says something, anything. But, you know, I don't think that she had to mask that trauma, but whatever she experienced, and that's probably, you know, it was good for her. It was like swift, and it was said and done. And then she moved to New York. She was only expecting to live in New York for a year, but then she moved to Vanity Fair, which she was kind of like against in a way.
Yeah.
She really wasn't fashion. She was like rock and roll. She was like documentarian, you know.
Very
she,
much.
She liked to take photos of what was going on, not necessarily like these beautiful fashion portraits of like these celebrities.
Completely different. Yeah, really.
And so instead of rolling with the punches for that, now she was introduced to a whole fucking team of like makeup artists and like wardrobe artists. And like, she was such a fly on the wall that she really didn't know how to deal with people. And so I think I don't know if she still has this reputation now, but she started forming this reputation of like being a bitch.
Okay. And like, every time a woman,
right?
It's
somehow every time a woman is like good at something,
yeah,
like if a man does it, it's, you know, he's just really good at his job.
Yeah. Like, yeah,
but as soon as a woman does it, oh wow, she's just a flying bitch. Like,
yeah.
And you know what, I personally like to work with bitches because I learn things.
Yes. Like, exactly.
I need someone to tell me to do stuff.
That's what's that quote? Bitches get shit done. Mm.
Bitches get shit done, Lynx. Like, I would love to work with Annie. Annie, if you're hearing this, you know, I will do it for free. I will wipe your feet. You are my goddess. Hail Jesus. Like, so, you know, she was big on the whole, like, Avedon scenes. Avedon really represented New York to her. So when she thought of New York photographer, she thought of Avedon. And he was almost the reigning photographer of the time in New York. And she really looked up to his work during his reigning era in New York. And it makes sense why. I mean, he's an amazing photographer. That one photo of Natasia Kinski with a snake, I mean, hello, classic. So beautiful. You know, I watched a little documentary about him, you know, doing some research about photographers, different techniques, etc. And that photo was kind of not a fluke, but he hit his finger on the trigger button and the snake's tongue just like came out instantly.
So many like happy accidents like that.
Yeah. And that's what I love about photography, though, is because they're always like the best photos are always happy accidents. Like, yeah. It's so rare to have like the best photo as the photo that we were really, I mean, you were planning for it, but you know, it's really the moments before that are always the best, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Sometimes a client
thinks differently.
You know, thinks differently, but for me, it's like, damn, like it's just the seconds while, for example, you know, working on your lighting, you know, like those moments, and I'm like taking photos, like trying to figure out the lighting. Turns out they're the best photos, and those are the ones that I'll post on my Instagram.
Like, amazing.
Yeah. And so she, you know, she got to work with Vanity Fair, and she started working with Beatrice. I forgive me if I say pronounce her name wrong, but Feitler. I don't know. Feitler.
Yeah.
Yeah. Feitler.
Feitler sounds right.
Sounds right. Beatrice Feitler. And she was the art director of the time for Harper's Bazaar. And then obviously when Vanity Fair was doing their revamp, basically when Annie Leibovitz stepped in, they worked together. And it was really B. Feitler who kind of made Annie really hone in on her work. So looking at the photos that she was taking and figuring out which ones were good.
Like, was she like a mentor or maybe like a partner?
She was like, I guess she was a mentor in a way. I mean, obviously a partner too, because she was a creative director.
Yeah.
And so she obviously worked really closely with Annie because, you know, again, B is very nitty gritty and she really wants specific.
Kind of took her things to the next level.
Yeah. And so it was at that moment where Annie was like, okay, like this is what makes the photo better. Or like, you know, this is the one out of like this whole call, like 300 photos. This is why this one stands out. So it really like it really introduced her to like really selecting the photo. And again, I think this really kind of drove home making concepts of photos too. Like it was kind of like, okay, it has to be like a specific photo and like that's it.
You're not getting a candid. You're purposely trying to sort of get a shot.
That's right. Because before it was very candid. She didn't really know
yeah.
what was going on. And lucky her, she was kind of like in that kind of like realm when everything working up, you know? So lucky, like such, she's lucky in the sense of like Oprah lucky. So Oprah has this definition of luck where it's kind of like, oh yeah, you're in the right time in the right place, but you also, you know, have the skill level of doing it, you know? So it's basically just like skill and the time and place. And when those three things come together, like that's when magic happens.
Yes.
And so she was lucky in that sense.
Gotcha.
So she was constantly investigating what other photographers were doing and started forming conceptual photo shoots. And then so she had this really bad photo shoot with Bruce Springsteen, James Taylor, Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Brown, and Carly Simon.
Okay.
And it was like literally just a really shitty photo. And B. Feitler was like, no. Like, what the fuck, Annie? What were you thinking? This is a terrible photo. Like, we don't even know if we should, like, run it.
Interesting. So she just, like, didn't know what to do with all of them.
Didn't know what to do. Like, it was just, like, a really shitty photo.
Okay.
And, like, when you see it, it's like, yeah, it's, like, a very basic shitty photo. It looks like an event photo. Like, you know what I mean? There's no love into it, basically. And it was basically a learning experience for her that pushed her to become more creative in her shoots. So one of her most famous conceptual shoots are of Bette Midler in a bed of roses, which that is so iconic, that photo.
Yeah.
Like, I'm pretty sure American Beauty stole that whole idea of, you know what I mean? And I love that movie.
That's interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Bette was like, no, like, I'm going to be scratched to shit.
Yeah. Then
Annie and her team cut every single thorn off those roses so she would be comfortable.
What an angel.
Isn't it amazing? I don't have the patience. Bet you'd be...
You bleed for me.
Yeah, you bleed for me, woman. No, I love that. Oh, I love her so much. That's a whole other story. So it wasn't until an assignment from Time Magazine about poets that really brought it home for Annie, where she really understood what she wanted in her photographs. And she has a quote that says, "To understand that I could incorporate the poetry, something about the person, into the photograph." So this was really the moment where she was like, you know, I have to incorporate something into the photograph that really makes it, you know, that's Annie. You know, I don't think a lot of people were doing that at the time. And I think that that was really what kind of created her her whole vibe, you know? And now everyone's kind of copying it, including myself. Like, I obviously look up to her.
Of course.
a lot. Obviously not copying her, but, you know, incorporating a lot of, like, you know, what she's done over the years into, like, my own work and, you know, like, working on my own thing.
Yeah. But, and taking that advice and, like, knowing your subject and trying to make sure that they come out in it.
Mm-hmm. And what's very interesting, actually, and maybe it's just been, like, the from looking at all of her photos, like, historically, but I didn't know that that was basically what she was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes sense because that's what I wanted to do. And maybe it's because I was, like, looking at her photographs or, like, just, you know, that's what I want to do. I want to incorporate what people love into their photographs. Like, I want to incorporate a humanity into the photograph.
For sure.
And that's what she's been doing this whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. I click with her so well. So, you know, that quote really was kind of like, oh, my God, like, that's exactly what I want to do in my photographs. And you know, she's just so ahead of her time,
for sure. And she was already doing that with the candids, like, she she was, like, seeing her subject, but it's just, like, a level up, like, taking that, and
now she's conscious of it.
Yes,
before she was, like, so unconscious of it.
Yes, and, like, you can make a statement with each photo now, not just capture great moments. You can think about it. That's amazing.
Which I guess, I don't know, in I don't know, contemporary culture, I guess that you would consider that as an artist, right?
For sure. Absolutely.
As before, she was, like, quite simply just, like, a fly on the wall photographer taking photos for Rolling Stones, where some people would maybe question if that's art, but now it's kind of like art. Like, she's really bringing art to photography. And, you know, there's a whole debate on if photography is an art to begin with. Obviously, I think it is. It's not necessarily the medium that you're using. It's the whole, like, idea. You know, the medium is a message, I suppose.
For sure.
I still don't really understand what that quote means, but, like,
it works.
It works. I'm not smart enough. Yeah, so many of her concepts were quite simple. So, for example, you know, the Fleetwood, the really famous Fleetwood Mac.
The bed one?
The bed one.
Yeah.
And so the whole rumor, obviously, was they were fucking each other, you know.
I mean,
and
they were.
They were. No. So maybe not a rumor. I mean, although they do have that
amazing
album, Rumors. So maybe they just created their own rumor. Like, who knows? Like, were they fucking each other?
They definitely were.
They definitely were.
feel the tension.
You really could. But they were also creating their own rumors, which I do time to time. I like to spark my own rumors. It keeps things interesting. And then, you know, the Patti Smith photos where she's taken so many photos of Patti Smith. But a particular photo that she took of Patti Smith was there was actually fire behind her.
I love that photo so much.
Oh, it's so good. It's interesting, the story leading up to that is that actually, like, Patti Smith was, like, catching on fire. Like,
oh, no way. Yeah, is that, like, close to her?
She was, like, really fucking hot. Like, she was, like, literally singed from that photo shoot. Yeah.
So, it was worth it.
It was worth it, folks. Patti Smith is legend.
Yeah.
Legend.
I love that for Bette Midler. It's like, oh, we can't let one thorn get her, but for Patti Smith it's like, let her catch fire.
Because she's such a bad bitch, so you know that it's gonna work. Could you imagine Patti Smith and Bette Midler in, like, the same room though? Like, what a vibe.
That's like a great dinner party.
Like one of those, like, who would you bring to a dinner party? Bette Midler and Patti Smith.
And Annie Leibovitz to take the photos.
Right. Oh my God. Obviously. I would say me, but no. I want to be in these photos, okay? And so obviously, you know, what we talked about, Bette Midler's rose, where, like, she cut off, like, every thorn. Could you imagine? I just love that. That's just, I mean, she had a team behind her, but, you know, like, she was doing the work too, you know? Yeah. It's not like she's just telling people to do these things, you know? She moves the chairs. She moves the tables.
And, like, the detail that she put in, like, that's...
Yes, just everything. Yeah. I love it so much. She has taken so many photos of John Lennon.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's one in particular. Anyone know it?
That amazing shot of John naked, curled up with Yoko. Iconic. Absolutely iconic.
Yoko Ono has a little quote, which I love. It was the height of intimacy for both of us around that time.
You can tell. It's like the most beautiful shot.
It's just so beautiful.
Yeah.
And they're so comfortable. So it was actually Annie's whole idea of this whole like nudity thing. And she asked Yoko if she was comfortable with being nude, to which she said no. And she's like, all right, let's just roll with it. Put all of the clothes on. You know what I mean? Like, and so I really like the whole, you know, again, I guess it's kind of, you know, Annie kind of rolls with the punches and then these amazing, beautiful things happen.
Yeah.
And I think that's so important with photography, because if you go in wanting a photo, you have to roll with the punches, because not everything is going to be 100%. And if you don't roll with the punches, then great things aren't going to happen.
Yeah.
Because people aren't going to be comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, it's so important to make everyone comfortable. And that's like the hairstylist, the wardrobe artist. Everyone has to be comfortable, because if one person's having a bad day,
it affects everything.
It's going to affect everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so important to have a good team.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And with them, I'm not sure if they actually had a team. I think it was probably just Annie and them.
I bet. I'm sure it's just Annie and John mm-hmm. and Yoko. And maybe some like lighting. I don't know.
Yeah. And so she basically just directed them to do this.
Yeah.
And Lennon could have easily said no, but he was totally okay with showing his vulnerability at that time.
Yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately, dire things happened 5 hours later. 5 hours later.
That's
Lynx.
Like the last shot of him.
Like, insane. That's that is crazy. Insanity to me. Yeah.
That must be, as Yoko, probably her most important favorite photograph mm-hmm. ever, because again, like, you can see their love and like the vulnerability, and it's just, it's such an incredible shot. It's such an incredible photograph. And 5 hours mm-hmm. my God.
Yeah. And that photo really didn't need any captions.
No.
So when they printed it, there was like nothing. It was just the Rolling Stones
on the cover.
Yeah. It was just like the Rolling Stones, you know, header, and then that was it. Like, that was,
yeah, what can you say
there? Yeah, you don't have to say anything.
The picture, like, does
it, yeah, like a thousand, what is that, like
a picture
speaks a thousand words. I should know this, folks, but but yeah, so her, when, you know, when she transitioned to Vanity Fair, she was asked to work for Vanity Fair. It's not like she went there. She was asked, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they knew that it was going to be this big thing, you know? Like, they knew her work previously. It was very documentary. It wasn't fashion. It wasn't high budget kind of stuff. And mm-hmm. then now, you know, this very fly on the wall kind of, I don't know if I want to say introverted person, but, you know, I feel like some of her traits are very, like, introverted, where, you know, she probably thought, especially at the time, that she works better on her own.
Yeah.
But a lot of people think that she's kind of hard to work with, but at the same time, like, obviously not, because, like, these images are just so beautiful, especially, like, lately. I don't know what's going on, Annie, but oh my God, like, they're just so beautiful.
Also, it's a different experience. She mm-hmm. was used to being that fly on the wall, mm-hmm. working alone. It takes time to adjust, to find her place, I'm sure, in all of that too. It's like,
absolutely,
I don't think she was a bitch or whatever.
No,
like, I think she was
just directing
her
things,
place,
yes,
and everything,
exactly,
and like figuring out how to work with people mm-hmm. and like how you all come together. And
mm-hmm. and I think that you need that to be like the photographer, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, you have to put your foot down.
You have to have,
like,
authority.
You need authority, because if you don't have authority, then you're just going to be like, oh, like, you're just like the hired photographer.
Yep.
You're not Annie. You're the hired photographer.
And you're,
right?
hired to know what you want and to get that shot.
Exactly. And so I think I really urge all photographers to really put their foot down when it comes, because really, when your final image is out there, it's out there.
Yeah.
And everyone's going to be looking at it. And there's no excuse for anyone else except for yourself. And so Annie has this quote that, where basically, like, you know, she doesn't blame anyone else except herself if it's a bad photo.
Mm-hmm.
And 110%. If I have a bad photo of someone, honestly, I mean, it hasn't happened in the sense of, like, I have to do, like, another photo, but I will totally give you, if I don't think a photo is good,
yeah,
like, I'm going to have to do that again for free, because I just cannot bring something out into the world where I'm not like 100%.
For sure.
I feel like that's why, you know, I look up to Annie so much, is because her philosophy about photography, I really kind of hone into that.
For sure.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, with Vanity Fair, she has this very famous photo with Demi Moore. I'm not sure if you've seen it, Lynx.
The pregnancy one?
Yeah, pregnancy photo.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't know what maternity photographers were doing at the time, but that photo, I mean, I feel like every maternity photographer is basically just copying that photo now.
Absolutely. Like, I've seen that photo a million times.
Oh, a million, billion times. Yeah.
Even on other covers of magazines, mm-hmm. and other actresses.
Like, no one would have done that. And it was like, it was such a big thing back then. Now we don't even bat an eyelash because we've seen it before, but like, she was the first one to really do that.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
A nude.
Oh, and I bet a lot of people had a lot of things to say about that.
Oh, my God. For the better or for the worse, you know? Yeah. Like, on one hand, it was like, oh, my God, this, like, because maternity is really beautiful. Like,
of course.
Oh, my God. Like, that is a one-in-a-lifetime chance.
Absolutely.
So it's, I think maternity are so beautiful.
Yeah.
But on the other side, there are, like, you know, a lot of people who are very...
Uptight?
Uptight. Like, oh, my God. Like, a naked woman who added her...
With a belly?
With a belly.
I only want my women God naked forbid. With no bellies.
God forbid.
Yeah. And it's so like the beautiful. Most natural thing in life. Mm-hmm. Like literally every person who's
right.
alive right now, this is
where they
started.
Yeah.
But yeah, people.
I think it's honestly one of my most favorite shots of Annie's. And I love Demi Moore, especially of that time.
Yeah.
And she was very vocal too. I mean, I think it kind of like... teetered off, but she was kind of like a vocal celebrity.
Yeah. And you know? Again, like, yeah, for sure, doing that shot was a feminist move.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I haven't really touched on this, and maybe we can touch on that a little bit later, but she was dating that, you know, a feminist, maybe not at the time. I'm pretty sure she was at the time, but she was dating someone, and you know, they had a lot of troubles, and we'll definitely speak on that. But
okay, we'll get to that in a moment.
So Annie has this really famous quote where it really speaks to like the detriment of her celebrity, where she was really starting to get known. Like everyone wanted to get a photo of her, and everyone was like, oh my God, it's just an amazing photograph just because she took it.
Gotcha.
Whereas it really wasn't that great of a photo. And the one thing I really like about Annie is that she doesn't really fake it as an artist. You know, there are so many different artists out there who are like, you know, an honest mistake happens and it turns out to be like this beautiful, amazing image.
Yeah.
Where some photographers are like, oh, I purposely did this and I purposely did that. Where it's like, okay, you're clearly bullshitting.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean? Versus Annie, where it's like, no, it was like literally I just did this. Like it was a happy accident. It happened. Right. And so she has this quote of saying, it's been the bane of my existence. Someone being so famous and totally relying on that versus trying to get, you know, just take a good photograph.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Right. And so she, all her purpose is to take a good photograph. She doesn't really care about the celebrity. Who gives a fuck if you know what I mean? Like, if you know who I am, I just want to take a good photo of you.
Yeah.
And I think that's like so humble almost of her, where it's like, fuck the celebrity.
Yeah.
I just want to be a photograph. Yeah. I just want to take a good photograph.
Yeah.
Like at the end of the day, whatever you're hiring me for, I'm going to take a good photograph of you. And that's all she wants.
Yeah.
And there are so many people who... she said that she still needs to take a good photograph of them because she's photographed them. But for her, they're not the best photograph. She just knows.
Yeah.
Right. And it's probably just because
it's a good photograph, but it's not like meaningful or not in a way that she wanted to get something out.
Right. And I feel like for the people who she's talked about this, how she said she can't get like the best photo of them.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of the times it's because she has a deeper connection with them.
Interesting.
Right? So it's kind of like she just hasn't really fulfilled them as a person in a photograph.
It's interesting too, because in the late 90s and 2000s with Vanity Fair, I feel like she's really famous for those fold out cover issues.
Mm-hmm. Centerfold.
Yes. And they're always beautiful and amazing, but they are very different from her other work.
Mm-hmm.
And it is like commercialized.
It's super commercialized.
And I can understand why it's harder to get that perfect shot, that shot that you want when like you're thinking about advertising and things like that and money and like you're trying to sell something, mm-hmm. right? You're trying to sell the magazine. So mm-hmm. it's a different type of shoot. Mm-hmm. Very, very different from the Rolling Stone stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. And she kind of talks about that too. Like, her favorite images are not in Vanity Fair. You know what I mean? Like, maybe in the covers of, or in the pages of Vanity Fair, certainly not the cover.
Yeah.
She doesn't like in studio work. She hates that.
Yeah.
But she, you know, she talks about, like, you know, her most favorite photos of, like, are photos of her mom and her family and, you yeah. know, her partner at the time, Susan Sontag, who was a feminist, human rights, you know,
a writer.
She was like the intellect of the time.
Yep.
And that, you know, comes with a lot of goods and it comes with a lot of bads.
Yeah.
So obviously the goods are Susan really kind of pushed her to conceptualize these images in a way of like just sometimes political, like politicizing her images, which is a really great and amazing thing. I think the downside of that is that Susan was oftentimes, should I say, a bully. She was very verbally abusive to Annie. So like, you know, they would be hanging out with friends and Susan would kind of discredit Annie's intelligence.
I get you. You're not the intellectual like we are.
Like, right.
You're doing the dumb commercials. One. You're doing this.
Yeah, yeah. And she would like literally use words like dumb, stupid. Oh. Yeah, so she was very, like, emotionally abusive to Annie. And just Annie was just so in love with her. She was in love with her as a person, her intellect. You know, and Annie, I think, really, Annie kind of believed that she wasn't as, like, superior or all-encompassing and intellectual.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, the same people in the room would be like, you know, Annie, you're the best photographer ever.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same vein, Susan would be like, you know, Annie, you know you're the best photographer. But it's like, okay, if it, being a photographer isn't at the same standard as like an intellectual.
I got you.
So I think that was like a huge issue when it comes to their relationship. And I know that Susan, her son, doesn't like Annie. Like there's like a lot of kind of like relationship issues there. And as much as Susan was like this, you know, gung-ho, upfront, humanitarian, who was like very pro-feminine rights and pro-gay rights, you know,
yep.
back then they would call her a pornographer.
Yep.
But now, today's standards, she was literally just talking about gay rights, yep. you know?
Yep.
But it was also very interesting because she didn't really come out. She never told her mother that she was seeing Annie.
I remember it was pretty recently where I found out that they were uh-huh. a couple and I never knew before. And it was like, mm-hmm. it makes sense to me, which is also interesting because it's like, oh, you're not an intellectual. But like, yeah, they are on each other's level for mm-hmm. sure.
Just in different ways, you know?
Yes, and exactly.
I think a lot of people, I mean, maybe this is just like going off topic, but I think a lot of people think of intelligence as like literally just academic or reading books.
Yeah.
And I think that's total bullshit. I think intellectual or intellectualism, like you can find it in so many different facets of different
Absolutely.
You can be a creative intellectual, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that Annie is a creative intellectual. You know, she sees people as people. She can pick something out from someone that they might not even see in themselves yeah. and present it in a photo.
She might not be able to like quote an obscure author,
mm-hmm.
but absolutely she's an intellectual.
Yeah.
She sees things that other people don't see. Mm-hmm. Like she... her brain works in a way that other people's doesn't, just like Susan.
Right, exactly. And then I, you know, of course, I go through the rabbit hole and I, you know, I start watching documentaries about Susan. And so I think psychologically, not, you know, making an excuse for like all of the verbal abuse or the abuse that she gave to Annie,
yeah.
but I think that she just had a lot of kind of childhood trauma that she was also kind of dealing with
yep.
and that, in the sense of like when she realized that people started loving her and were getting too close to her, she would kind of attack. It would
yeah.
be like, you know, and it's kind of like self-sabotage in
oh,
a way.
Oh, for sure.
You know?
For sure.
It was just Annie was relentless with the love. Like Annie was just like in love with her, you know, until
and I'm
the
sure,
moment she died.
Like in her heart, probably she was like trying to build Annie up. Like you're already mm-hmm. doing great. Push it more this mm-hmm. way. But like, doing it in not the
best way. Yeah. Like, it's not really what you say, it's how you say it. And I think that maybe Susan was kind of...
How long were they together, do you know?
Like, oh my gosh, I think they were together for like 20 or 30 years. That's like crazy. A long time.
Quite a while.
Mm-hmm. Like a long, long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then again, I really don't know...
dates or anything, but yeah. More than a decade.
For more than a decade, for sure. I would say like 20 years, I think. Like, I should probably know this, but...
I mean, no one knew it.
Yeah, no one knew it. That's the truth. Like, it really only came up in, like, recent years, like you said, where it's like, you know, it was actually out. And I think that's also to the credit. I mean, I know that, you know, Susan Sontag's, like, son didn't really like Annie, but he also wrote books about his mother, and he incorporated Annie. And although he didn't necessarily like Annie, he also realized that his mom was abusive.
And recognized that Annie's a huge part of her life.
That's right. And he told his mom, he's like, "Mom, like, you can't just keep calling her stupid. Like, whether you, like, either you think she's stupid and useless as a partner, or you should break up with her." You know what I mean? Like, what's the point of going on with this relationship? And I think that that's what the relationship was. It was just kind of like an abusive relationship. Kind of codependent in a way.
Yeah, for sure.
You know? And who wants to be in that relationship? But
it's when hard to get out of it.
It's hard to get out of. And it's so easy for people to criticize and say that they could never be in that relationship. But really, like, it happens.
When you're in someone?
Yeah. When you're in it. And you might not even realize that you're in it until it's too late. So...
Absolutely.
So one interesting note that Susan and her kind of disagreed with was that Susan believed that taking photographs interfered with the actual experience. So she thought photography changed everything.
That's interesting.
Which I would agree with in like the beginning stages. Okay, everyone recognizes that there's a photograph there. So like, for example, a wedding, yes. You know, when the guests aren't really used to being photographed, they're going to act a certain way, or they're going to be a little awkward or shy or what have you. But when you are with a group for a long period of time and they're just used to you having your camera, is that really interfering with the experience, or is it actually maybe even enhancing the experience?
It can go both ways.
It can absolutely go both ways. Yeah. So I don't necessarily think that it interferes. I think maybe most experiences might interfere, but when people aren't paying attention to the camera and
they're just
doing their own thing.
That's what makes a good photographer, like the fly on the wall thing.
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
That's what makes a good documentarian.
Absolutely.
Because you're taking photos of someone doing something when they don't even realize that you're taking a photo, or even if you have a camera, you know? Yeah. So Anne thought it was very easy to photograph her because she knew herself so well, but at the same time, she never really thought that she took like the best photograph of her. And I think that really also brings again what I said, where Anne never really thought that she took the best photographs of people that she loved.
Too close.
Right? She was just too close to them. And so I think for her, she could never encapsulate who they were as a person because she knew too much of them. Like, humans are so diverse. And so you can't really take a photo of someone as like an all-encompassing photo.
Yeah.
Right? And she also said this about celebrities that she took photos of, right? Like, as much as she probably wanted to do that, she, you know, you can't do that. So good luck to any photographer. I urge you to to somehow get a photo of an all-encompassing photo of someone.
Yeah.
Good luck. The races start.
It's like the Holy Grail of a photo.
Right? Yeah. Because you can't.
No.
You really can't. And so she was an incredible, important person in Annie's life, and Susan could put into words where Annie couldn't.
Yeah, that's good. Right? Annie captured moments. Susan had the words.
And I think that when Susan said, "Oh, you know, a photograph or taking photos can change, you know, can interfere with life."
Yeah.
You know, I think that's also, again, kind of discrediting Annie, because it's kind of like, you know, you can only really work with words. And I don't really agree with that.
I don't agree either.
Yeah. Like, you know, like, I think that sometimes you can't put together words to formulate.
That was Susan's creative outlet.
Right. And everyone has a creative outlet, you know? So it is just what it is. You know, it was just kind of an abusive relationship. And so she came into the relationship thinking that she wanted to be around the amazing intellectual person, and Susan loved Annie's work, and she always pushed her to be more serious as a photographer. But at the same time, it was kind of, you know, I feel like Annie loved that about her. So a lot of people around Annie was like, you know, like, Susan's really, like, discrediting you. But with Annie, it was, like, positive criticism, yeah. You know? So I guess it's, like, the perception yeah. of the abuse, right? Like, how do you perceive someone telling you that you're stupid and that you, you know, your work sucks? You know, are you going to perceive that as in a good thing? You know, as like an optimistic kind of, you know, yeah, I should be trying better. Or are you going to perceive that as like, oh my God, my life work sucks?
Personal relationships are the most complicated thing. Mm-hmm. For one person, something can feel abusive, and for another person, maybe not. Maybe that supportive, or maybe just encouraging, or it depends on the person. Mm-hmm. No one can judge a personal relationship.
Right. Like, you really can't. Like, all you see, and it's either the good things or the bad things.
You never see the most intimate, beautiful mm-hmm. moments. Mm-hmm. Those are between two people.
Right, alone. Right. Yeah, and Annie says, like, you know, we had the most beautiful moments more, like, that outweigh the bad moments, you know? And I think that's, like, with every relationship.
Yeah.
And you can kind of say that in, like, every relationship too, where like, where, you know, you see a relationship like, oh my God, they're so amazing, blah blah blah, when really, like, at home, you really don't know what's happening
when
no one's around. And very similarly, you know, like, the relationships were like, oh my God, that's bound to end, you know.
Yeah.
When really, like, I bet they have, like, amazing moments by themselves.
Absolutely.
You know, people change when it's, you know, when people say three's a crowd, you know, three is a crowd. And when you add, like, three more people to that, or, like, you know, a house party, it changes people's...
Everything.
Everything. It changes people's behaviors,
yeah.
what they believe, what they think, blah, blah, blah. You know, it just changes people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, unfortunately, you know, Susan, at a point, she got a bone marrow transplant, which failed. And it was the first time that she thought that she could take some pictures. And Susan was her muse for so many years. And it really broke her after Susan's passing. Like, when Susan died, it, like, really kind of set her off into a depression.
I bet.
I mean, yeah, like, the love of your life, right? Like, yep. She's gone. So, I mean, it doesn't really matter what other people thought. You know, Annie loved her.
Yeah.
And, like, that's the most important thing.
Yeah, that was her partner.
That was her partner. That was, like, her rock, really.
Yeah.
You know, it's a sad thing when someone passes.
Annie took some shots of Susan in the hospital.
In the hospital while she was dying. And a lot of people really kind of, like, judged her for that. It was like, you know, these are, like, her dying moments. And I'm like, that was the relationship they had, number one. And number two, why do we have to think of these moments, these, like, dying moments of, like, these, like, sad or, like...
We're all gonna die.
And it's a part of... It's a stage of life that we're all gonna go through.
Yep.
And I don't think it's disrespectful when, you know, you really have to look at the context. Okay, yeah. Am I taking a photo of someone who's dying and, like, laughing about it later? Okay.
Or without permission.
Or it's like, okay, obviously that would be disrespectful, but... Like, when you take a photo and the context is like, okay, you know, like, I loved and cherished this person
yes.
for their whole life, and I want to see them.
In this, you know, most intimate moment.
Right.
I want to be there with them. I want to capture it. I want to.
Absolutely.
I totally get it.
Why not, you
yeah.
know?
I get it. And again, yeah, like, as a photographer, you also see moments that a lot of people don't pick mm-hmm. up on. You know, you're seeing beauty mm-hmm. in everything, where some people just shut that out mm-hmm. or don't have that ability.
You know, Annie has a quote that says, in the wake of loss, it felt comforting to take pictures. So
beautiful.
You know, again, it's kind of like a coping mechanism to have yeah. a camera to take photos of these moments that can last forever.
So as far as I know, after Vanity Fair, she started working with Vogue, and that was also a very different, or was it Vogue?
It was Vogue. She works with Vogue.
I should say, after Vanity Fair, learning about that led her into fashion,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which is, again, something so far off from where she
so
started.
So far off. And she doesn't really even consider herself as a fashion photographer. I mean, she considers herself as just a photographer. I mean, she's done landscapes. She's done still lifes.
Yeah. I mean, of course, she's not just a fashion right. photographer by any means.
Right, right. And I mean, even, you know, I think she's known for doing fashion photography and, you know, celebrity portraiture, but it's just, like, not her.
It's interesting, too, because, like, that's where the money is. Like,
that's where the money is.
And, like, you see those photo shoots and you're like, wow, they put a lot of money into this, a lot of, like you said, a lot of like behind the scenes work. Like there's
a lot of people, two week shoots. Like a lot of people look at these images and like, oh wow, they're like really pretty. But yeah, they're 2 weeks to take a photo.
Yeah.
It's just a lot of work, the whole wardrobe. So, you know, they bring the whole wardrobe in and it takes like a week to figure out the wardrobe and hair and makeup. And then, you know, Annie has like, you know, a whole weekend or like a 4 day, 4 or 5 day workload for her of taking these photographs. Yeah. And so, for example, she took a photo of the queen, which only took like half an hour. And so very interesting because I wouldn't say that they butt heads, but they're very strong women.
Yes.
So Annie wanted one thing, you know, the queen wanted another thing. And so, for example, the Annie was like, oh, yeah, take off your crown.
Oh.
And the queen's like, and hell no. Do you know how long it took me to put this thing on? But then eventually they built a relationship. And so Annie took all of these amazing, you know, there's like this one shot of like the queen and her corgis, you know, and it's just like very lifestyle portraits. And I don't think anyone else has taken photos in that kind of vein before, you know, of like the queen just being a normal human fucking being, you know? And again, I think that's very much like what Hillary Clinton said, is that she personifies these people in her portraits. And it's kind of like no one really sees the queen as a human being. They think of her as just like this majestic being with a crown. And Annie's like, no, let's ditch the crown.
Yeah.
Let's bring in the dogs. Yeah. You know? I love that, you know?
Me too.
That's
her like taking her early work and her later work and like melding it together.
Like, let's make this fashion.
Yeah.
But let's also tell a story.
Yeah. And candid as well, where it's like, let's put you in your happy element where you'd be doing anyway right now, like hanging out with your pets, but like high end.
And again, it's like always like relationship building, right? Like 30 minutes turned into probably like an hour with the queen, turned into like a day with the queen, turned into, you know? And she has this very strong personality where it's kind of hard not to like her, you know? Like she just kind of creeps in. You know, whether you like working with her or not, she's just an amazing fucking human being. And again, Annie, if you're listening to this, you can hire me any minute.
So Annie's been celebrated a lot. She's one of those people who are lucky enough to be living while people celebrate her.
And she's 70, okay? Damn. And she's still working.
Still working, still killing it. I looked her up. I saw she has like another book coming out soon.
Yeah. Oh my God. What is that? Like her 12th book or something?
Yeah. I mean, she probably has enough photos for like 100 books.
A lifetime. Yeah. I'm sure there's going to be books even when she passes. Like, for sure. People are just going to.
And forever exhibits of her work. And she's iconic.
She's definitely like the photographer of her lifetime. I mean, most people know of. Like even people who are just not into photography at all.
Know her name.
Like they know who she is.
And no matter who you are, you know an image of hers.
Absolutely.
You might not know it's hers.
Right.
Like, but you've seen her images.
You would have to be living under a rock, I think, at this point to not know, you know.
And again, I feel like she has such a specific way about her and the way she goes about it where you automatically are like, Annie Leibovitz. Annie Leibovitz did this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even from, again, the candids to the portraits to the fashion.
Yeah.
She is one of a kind and she has a look to her.
Mm-hmm.
One thing before we wrap up, I just wanted, because we talked about this a little earlier before I turned on the mics, where it's interesting because we give her all the credit, but there are so many people behind the scenes who also make these photos amazing.
The editing is just... And I know that she works with editors, and I'm not sure how much she works with them, but I feel like editing is such a process that they should be credited. Like, editing takes hours of work, you know? I think, you know, when you look through magazines, like, there's no, like, photo editor that is named, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure they're listed somewhere, but... It's not like Anne Leibovitz with this editor.
Right.
And I don't know, but I assume she probably works with the same person for, you know, all of her Vogue shoots. She probably has like one person, like that B woman who mentored her, like one person who's like really there for her.
Right.
And like contributing to those.
Yeah.
And
I'm sure she works with the same team. Like she knows, you know, she has her editor, but I feel like, naming the team is so important. Like, for who's doing the hair, who's doing the makeup, who's doing everything, you know?
And that's kind of what this podcast is about, too, where it's like there are so many people behind the scenes that you haven't heard of yet. Like, where are their stories?
I know.
So I just want people, when they're looking at those images, to like also remember it's not just Annie. She sets up the shot. She knows which, like, she has a vision, but there's so many people behind
her. Also, you know, I don't want to discredit Annie at all. I mean, she's worked so tremendously hard for what she's done. Yeah. But I think, you know, for the most part now, it just, it seems like she's, you know, her role as a photographer. So she has a whole lighting.
Yes.
You know, crew. So everyone's doing her lighting. Everyone's doing everything. She comes in and it's like, wham, bam. Thank you, ma'am. I took the photo.
Yep.
This is it, you know?
For like all the high end super shoots.
Yes.
That's a team.
That's a whole team, you know? And she's gotten to that point where she has a team, you know? Yeah. And she really did the grunt work to get to that point.
Someone should make a podcast about photography and talk about the behind the scenes people, the lighting people. The editors,
yes,
all of that, costumes, like all, like it's, there's just so many elements to it.
There's
right?
so many elements. It's a little crazy. And even like for the most part, honestly, photographers are unnamed. You know, Annie is only named because it's Annie. You know, she's Annie.
True.
You know, so she, and I think the only reason she really is named is because she has that persona. You know, like she is going in there supercharged.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you're a photographer, if you're a makeup artist, if you are a hairstylist, if you are editing the photos, you need to get in there and be supercharged in being like, no, this is who I am.
Yep.
And you're coming to me because of me, not necessarily because of, oh, you know, you can get this work anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, you have to put your stamp on something. And Annie put her stamp on some, you know, she put her stamp on photography. And you're not getting just a photo. You're getting an Annie Leibovitz photo, okay?
Exactly.
You're getting that photo. Like, that's a her photo. That's no one else's photo.
Before we wrap up, are there any other photographers that, like, really speak to you that you would want listeners to check out?
Yeah, so I have been following, I know this is a lot of photographers would probably know who she is, but it's Lindsay Adler, and she is like a very technical photographer.
Okay.
She's appeared in like, you know, Harper's Bazaar and et cetera, et cetera. But she is very technical. So when it comes to like learning photography techniques, she is like probably the go-to. I love her. I'm part of her little Facebook little photo group.
Love it.
You could absolutely just join that. I think it's like Lindsay Adler, you know, I don't even know what the name is, but it's probably like Photographer Club or something. Something ridiculous.
Look up Lindsay Adler.
Just search her up even on Facebook. And then right now I'm really digging Dina Goldstein. She does amazing work. So she has like tons of series. So like right now I think she's really kind of marketing and advertising this series with like senior rock and rollers.
Okay.
And they're like, you know, they have the whole mohawk look with like the leather.
Love it.
Love it, love it, love it. And they're kind of like just like these, you know, grimy old dudes. And I love it. Like these just like portraits of these rock and roll kind of, you know, like they lived their whole life as rock and rollers.
Yeah, that's them.
So cool. Like that's them, you know. I love it. I dig it so much. She also does this whole fairy tale character vibe of like living in the real world. So, for example, she has, and it's very, she, a lot of her images are kind of like ironic in a way, I would say, or juxtapositions these kind of fairy tales with kind of serious life events. Okay. So, for example, she pairs Rapunzel as a cancer patient in a hospital.
I see.
So it's this, you know, this girl on a bed and she has no hair, and then it's her braids kind of like cascading over her.
I see.
Or she has this work where it's Snow White and she's in this like very, I would say like middle class 1960s to 80s kind of household where she has like, you know, 7 kids.
Gotcha.
You know,
gotcha.
Really working her ass off, but you know,
sounds awesome though.
Yeah, yeah. I really recommend Dina Goldstein.
I'll check those two out.
Yeah, Dina Goldstein.
How can people check you out?
Well, you can check me out. I'm on Instagram, Mr. Pixie, M-I-S-T-E-R, Pixie, P-I-X-I-E. I know, I really make you spell it out. But yeah, that's how you can check my stuff out.
I will link that up and everything as well. Any last words? You good?
Famous last words. Follow me.
Follow? Yes.
I'm just kidding. I really don't care if you follow me, but I don't know. I feel like, you know, if you're a photographer, you know, just look at photographers that really kind of you feel for, whether that's like street photography, you know, still art, mm-hmm. just anything that you're kind of into,
yeah.
just do it, you know, do it, man. You could use your phone. You could use your tablet. I actually work. So I work as a community health worker, and I have I run a photography walk group with seniors. And I love them so much. They're so sweet. And we just take photos with our phones and our tablets. And it really, like, when you take photos of things and you start really getting in that mindset as, like, you know, a photographer, mm-hmm. it really is a lifestyle.
Yeah.
Whether you have your camera with you or not, you just look at the world differently. You look at the world, you notice things. I'm very ADHD, so, like, I just don't pay attention to anything. Mm-hmm. And so when I have my camera, or even when I don't have my camera, I've noticed that I've been noticing things more. You know, like, I just look at something and I'm like, oh, my God, that would be a beautiful yeah. photo, you know? And whether it turns out or not, it doesn't matter. But, no. like, you know, it kind of just, like, changes your life. And I think that there should be more research on, like, how maybe photography as a hobby
yeah.
would be a good therapy for, like, let's say, depression. There's a lot of research out there that suggests that when you take photos, or if you're a photographer, or even if you're taking photos of your food, it engages you into an activity. So, for example, yeah, if you're taking photos of your meal for the day, that actually engages you. And when it comes to your satisfaction of, like, your life experience, it shows that you actually have higher satisfaction.
That makes sense. You're becoming present in the moment because mm-hmm. you're capturing it.
Exactly. Yeah, you're more present. And, like, who cares if you're going to throw that photo out?
Yeah,
you know? Like, who cares?
Just for you.
It's just for you. Or, you know, you're going to post it on Facebook. Like, you know, maybe no one cares that you're eating an egg omelet.
But you do.
And who cares if anyone likes it, you know?
Exactly.
Don't delete your posts if no one likes them. Just don't do that. I don't want to tell you to do anything.
But don't delete your post.
But just don't delete your post.
Love it.
Yes.
This was amazing. Thank you for telling me Annie's story. And I love talking about Annie and photography. And
I feel like I was just like a countless run-on sentence. But I hope that people try to do their thing with photography or whatever art that they're going for, you know? And just know, like, Annie Leibovitz, like, really, like, she got a lot of people famous, you know? Like, she was a muse, but then she was also something more than a muse. Like, she, like, really, like,
yeah.
threw people into their
No one
careers.
Starts off at the top.
Exactly.
We all have to learn from experience. Mm. So get out there and do it yourself.
Yeah, just fucking do it.
Yeah.
You know, like, even if it's shit,
yeah,
just do it. And laugh it off later.
Exactly.
Like, you'll progress if you work at it. You know what I mean?
Thank you so much for this. I loved doing this, and so happy we waited to do it in person because it made it so much better.
Oh, so much better. Drinking wine on my floor.
All right. Well, till next time.
Till next time.
Muses is researched, edited, and produced by Lynx O'Leary.
Hello, dear stranger. I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the Heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.